little bit of shine to them. Billy, for one. But never anyone like the girl who had screamed into his head tonight. It had felt like that cry might tear him apart. Had he been that strong? He thought he had been, or almost. On closing day at the Overlook, Halloran had told the troubled little boy sitting beside him to... What had he said? He said to give him a blast. Dan had arrived back at Rivington House and was standing outside the gate. The first leaves had begun to fall, and an evening breeze whisked them around his feet. And when I asked him what I should think about, he told me anything. Just think it hard, he said. So I did, but at the last second I softened it, at least a little. If I hadn't, I think I might have killed him. He jerked back. No, he slammed back and bit his lip. I remember the blood. He called me a pistol. And later, he asked about Tony, my invisible friend, so I told him. Tony was back, it seemed, but he was no longer Dan's friend. Now, he was the friend of a little girl named Abra. She was in trouble, just as Dan had been, but grown men who sought out little girls attracted attention and suspicion. He had a good life here in Fraser, and he felt it was one he deserved after all the lost years. But when he needed Dick at the Overlook and later in Florida when Mrs. Massey had come back, Dick had come. In AA, people called that kind of thing a 12th-step call. Because when the pupil was ready, the teacher would appear. On several occasions, Dan had gone with Casey Kingsley and some other guys in the program to pay 12th-step calls on men who were over their heads in drugs or booze. Sometimes it was friends or bosses who asked for this service. More often it was relatives who had exhausted every other resource and were at their wits' end. They'd had a few successes over the years, but most visits ended with slam doors or an invitation for Casey and his friends to stick their sanctimonious, quasi-religious bullshit up their asses. One fellow, a meth-addled veteran of George Bush's splendid Iraq adventure, had actually waved a pistol at them. Heading back from the Chicoria hole-in-the-wall shack where the vet was denned up with his terrified wife, Dan had said, "That was a waste of time."
"It would be if we did it for them," Casey said, "but we don't. We do it for us. You like the life you're living, Danny boy?" It wasn't the first time he'd asked this question, and it wouldn't be the last. Yes, no hesitation on that score. Maybe he wasn't the president of General Motors or doing nude love scenes with Kate Winslet, but in Dan's mind, he had it all. "Think you earned it?"
"No," Dan said, smiling. "Not really. Can't earn this."
"So what was it that got you back to a place where you like getting up in the morning? Was it luck or grace?"
He'd believed that Casey wanted him to say it was grace. But during the sober years, he had learned the sometimes uncomfortable habit of honesty. "I don't know."
"That's okay, because when your back's against the wall, there's no difference."
5. "Abra, Abra, Abra," he said, as he walked up the path to Rivington House. "What have you gotten yourself into, girl? And what are you getting me into?" He was thinking he'd have to try to get in touch with her by using the Shining, which was never completely reliable, but when he stepped into his turret room, he saw that wouldn't be necessary. Written neatly on his blackboard was this: Kadabra@nhml.com. He puzzled over her screen name for a few seconds, then got it and laughed. "Good one, kid, good one." He powered up his laptop. A moment later, he was looking at a blank email form. He typed in her address and then sat watching the blinking cursor. How old was she? As far as he could calculate by their few previous communications, somewhere between a wise 12 and a slightly naive 16. Probably closer to the former. And here he was, a man old enough to have salt speckles in his stubble if he skipped shaving. Here he was getting ready to start compu-chatting with her. "To catch a predator, anyone?" "Maybe it's nothing. It could be. She's just a kid, after all." Yes, but one who was damn scared. Plus, he was curious about her. Had been for some time, the same way he supposed that Halloran had been curious about him. I could use a little bit of grace right now, and a whole lot of luck. In the subject box at the top of the email form, Dan wrote, "Hello, Abra." He dropped the cursor, took a deep breath, and typed four words, "Tell me what's wrong." 6. On the following Saturday afternoon, Dan was sitting in bright sunshine on one of the benches outside the ivy-covered stone building that housed the Anniston Public Library. He had a copy of the Union Leader open in front of him, and there were words on the page, but he had no idea what they said. He was too nervous. Promptly at 2 o'clock, a girl in jeans rode up on her bike and lodged it in the rack at the foot of the lawn. She gave him a wave and a big smile. So, Abra, as in Kadabra. She was tall for her age, most of that height in her legs. Masses of curly blonde hair were held back in a thick ponytail that looked ready to rebel and spray everywhere. The day was a bit chilly, and she was wearing a light jacket with Anniston Cyclones screen printed on the back. She grabbed a couple of books that were bungee corded to the rear bump of her bike, then ran up to him, still with that open smile. Pretty, but not beautiful, except for her wide-set blue eyes. They were beautiful. "Uncle Dan! Gee, it's good to see you!" And she gave him a hearty smack on the cheek. That hadn't been in the script. Her confidence in his basic okayness was terrifying. "Good to see you too, Abra. Sit down." He had told her they would have to be careful, and Abra, a child of her culture, understood at once. They had agreed that the best thing would be to meet in the open, and there were few places in Anniston more open than the front lawn of the library, which was situated near the middle of the small downtown district. She was looking at him with frank interest, perhaps even hunger. He could feel something like tiny fingers patting lightly at the inside of his head. "Where's Tony?" Dan touched a finger to his temple. Abra smiled, and that completed her beauty, turned her into a girl who would break hearts in another 4 or 5 years. "Hi, Tony!" That was loud enough to make him wince, and he thought again of how Dick Halloran had recoiled behind the wheel of his rental car, his eyes going momentarily blank.
"We need to talk out loud." "Okay, yes."
"I'm your father's cousin, okay? Not really an uncle, but that's what you call me."
"Right, right, your Uncle Dan. We'll be fine as long as my mother's best friend doesn't come along. Her name's Gretchen Silverlake. I think she knows our whole family tree, and there isn't very much of it."
Oh, great, Dan thought. The nosy best friend.
"It's okay," Abra said. "Her older son's on the football team, and she never misses a Cyclones game. Almost everyone goes to the game, so stop worrying that someone will think you're..."
She finished the sentence with a mental picture, a cartoon, really. It blossomed in an instant, crude but clear. A little girl in a dark alley was being menaced by a hulking man in a trench coat. The little girl's knees were knocking together, and just before the picture faded, Dan saw a word balloon form over her head.
"Eek! A freak!"
Actually not that funny. He made his own picture and sent it back to her. Dan Torrance in jail stripes being led away by two big policemen. He had never tried anything like this, and it wasn't as good as hers, but he was delighted to find he could do it at all. Then, almost before he knew what was happening, she appropriated his picture and made it her own. Dan pulled a gun from his waistband, pointed it at one of the cops, and pulled the trigger. A handkerchief with the word POW on it shot from the barrel of the gun. Dan stared at her, mouth open. Abra put fisted hands to her mouth and giggled.
"Sorry, couldn't resist. We could do this all afternoon, couldn't we? And it would be fun."
He guessed it would also be a relief. She had spent years with a splendid ball but no one to play catch with, and of course it was the same with him. For the first time since childhood, since Halloran, he was sending as well as receiving. "You're right, it would be, but now's not the time. You need to run through this whole thing again. The email you sent only hit the high spots."
"Where should I start?"
How about with your last name? Since I'm your honorary uncle, I probably should know. That made her laugh. Dan tried to keep a straight face and couldn't. God help him, he liked her already.
I'm Abra Rafaela Stone, she said. Suddenly the laughter was gone. I just hope the lady in the hat never finds that out.
7. They sat together on the bench outside the library for 45 minutes with the autumn sun warm on their faces. For the first time in her life, Abra felt unconditional pleasure, joy even, in the talent that had always puzzled and sometimes terrified her. Thanks to this man, she even had a name for it, The Shining. It was a good name, a comforting name, because she'd always thought of it as a dark thing. There was plenty to talk about, volumes of notes to compare, and they had hardly gotten started when a stout 50-ish woman in a tweed skirt came over to say hello. She looked at Dan with curiosity, but not untoward curiosity.
"Hi, Mrs. Gerard. This is my Uncle Dan. I had Mrs. Gerard for language arts last year."
"Pleased to meet you, ma'am. Dan Torrance." Mrs. Gerard took his offered hand and gave it a single, no-nonsense pump. Abra could feel Dan, Uncle Dan, relaxing. That was good.
"Are you in the area, Mr. Torrance?"
"Just down the road in Fraser. I work in the hospice there. Helen Rivington House."
"Ah, that's good work you do. Abra, have you read The Fixer yet? The Malama novel I recommended."
Abra looked glum.
"It's on my Nook. I got a gift card for my birthday, but I haven't started it yet. It looks hard."
"You're ready for hard things," Mrs. Gerard said. "More than ready. High school will be here sooner than you think, and then college. I suggest you get started today. Nice to have met you, Mr. Torrance. You have an extremely smart niece. But Abra, with brains comes responsibility." She tapped Abra's temple to emphasize this point, then mounted the library steps and went inside. She turned to Dan.
"That wasn't so bad, was it?"
"So far, so good," Dan agreed. "Of course, if she talks to your parents..."
"She won't. Mom's in Boston helping with my Momo. She's got cancer. I'm very sorry to hear it. Is Momo your..."
"Grandmother."
"Great-grandmother."
"Besides," Abra said, "we're not really lying about you being my uncle. In science last year, Mr. Staley told us that all humans share the same genetic plan. He said that the things that make us different are very small things. Did you know that we share something like 99% of our genetic makeup with dogs?"
"No," Dan said, "but it explains why Alpo has always looked so good to me."
She laughed. "So you could be my uncle or a cousin or whatever, all I'm saying."
"That's Abra's theory of relativity, is it?"
"I guess so. And do we need the same color eyes or hairline to be related? We've got something else in common that hardly anyone has. That makes us a special kind of relatives. Do you think it's a gene, like the one for blue eyes or red hair? And by the way, did you know that Scotland has the highest ratio of people with red hair?"
"I didn't," Dan said. "You're a font of information."
Her smile faded a little. "Is that a put-down?"
"Not at all.
I guess The Shining might be a gene, but I really don't think so. I think it's unquantifiable."
"Does that mean you can't figure it out? Like God and heaven and stuff like that?"
"Yes." He found himself thinking of Charlie Hayes, and all those before and after Charlie whom he'd seen out of this world in his Dr. Sleep persona. Some people called the moment of death passing on. Dan liked that because it seemed just about right. When you saw men and women pass on before your eyes, leaving the teeny town people called reality for some cloud gap of an afterlife, it changed your way of thinking. For those in mortal extremis, it was the world that was passing on. In those gateway moments, Dan had always felt in the presence of some not-quite-seen enormity. They slept. They woke. They went somewhere. They went on. He'd had reason to believe that even as a child.
"What are you thinking?" Abra asked. "I can see it, but I don't understand it. And I want to."
"I don't know how to explain it," he said.
It was partly about the ghosty people, wasn't it? I saw them once, on the little train in Fraser. It was a dream, but I think it was real.
His eyes widened. Did you really?
Yes. I don't think they wanted to hurt me. They just looked at me, but they were kind of scary. I think maybe they were people who rode the train in olden days. Have you seen ghosty people? You have, haven't you?
Yes, but not for a very long time. And some that were a lot more than ghosts. Ghosts didn't leave residue on toilet seats and shower curtains.
Abra, how much do your parents know about your shine?
My dad thinks it's gone except for a few things, like me calling from camp because I knew Momo was sick, and he's glad. My mom knows it's still there, because sometimes she'll ask me to help her find something she's lost. Last month it was her car key. She left them on Dad's work table in the garage, but she doesn't know how much is still there. They don't talk about it anymore. She paused.
Momo knows. She's not scared of it like Mom and Dad, but she told me I have to be careful, because if people found out,
she made a comic face, rolling her eyes and poking her tongue out the corner of her mouth.
Eek, a freak, you know?
Yes.
She smiled gratefully.
Sure you do.
Nobody else?
Well, Momo said I should talk to Dr. John because he already knew about some of the stuff. He, saw something I did with spoons when I was just a little kid. I kind of hung them on the ceiling.
This wouldn't by chance be John Dalton, would it?
Her face lit up. You know him?
As a matter of fact, I do. I found something once for him. Something he lost.
A watch.
That's right.
I don't tell him everything,
Abra said. She looked uneasy.
I sure didn't tell him about the baseball boy, and I'd never tell him about the woman in the hat, because he'd tell my folks and they've got a lot on their minds already. Besides, what could they do?
Let's just file that away for now. Who's the baseball boy?
Bradley Trevor. Brad. Sometimes he used to turn his hat around and call it a rally cap. Do you know what that is?
Dan nodded.
He's dead. They killed him. But they hurt him first. They hurt him so bad.
Her lower lip began to tremble, and all at once she looked closer to 9 than almost 13.
Don't cry, Abra. We can't afford to attract.
I know, I know.
She lowered her head, took several deep breaths, and looked up at him again. Her eyes were overbright, but her mouth had stopped trembling.
I'm okay, she said. Really, I'm just glad not to be alone with this inside my head.
8. He listened carefully as she described what she remembered of her initial encounter with Bradley Trevor 2 years ago. It wasn't much. The clearest image she retained was of many crisscrossing flashlight beams illuminating him as he lay on the ground. And his screams. She remembered those.
They had to light him up because they were doing some kind of operation, Abra said. That's what they called it anyway. But all they were really doing was torturing him.
She told him about finding Bradley again on the back page of the Aniston Shopper with all the other missing children, how she had touched his picture to see if she could find out about him.
Can you do that? She asked. Touch things and get pictures in your head? Find things out?
Sometimes. Not always. I used to be able to do it more and more reliably when I was a kid.
Do you think I'll grow out of it? I wouldn't mind that.
She paused, thinking.
Except I sort of would. It's hard to explain.
I know what you mean. It's our thing, isn't it? What we can do.
Abra smiled.
You're pretty sure you know where they killed this boy?
Yes, and they buried him there. They even buried his baseball glove.
Abra handed him a piece of notebook paper. It was a copy, not the original. She would have been embarrassed for anyone to see how she had written the names of the boys in round here, not just once, but over and over again.
Even the way they had been written now seemed all wrong. Those big, fat letters that were supposed to express not L-O-V-E, but L-U-V.
Don't get bent out of shape about it, Dan said absently, studying what she'd printed on the sheet.
I had a thing for Stevie Nicks when I was your age. Also for Ann Wilson of Heart. You've probably never even heard of her. She's old school, but I used to daydream about inviting her to one of the Friday night dances at Glenwood Junior High. How's that for stupid? She was staring at him open-mouthed. Stupid, but normal. Most normal thing in the world, so cut yourself some slack. And I wasn't peeking, Abra. It was just there, kind of jumped out in my face.
Oh, God.
Abra's cheeks had gone bright red.
This is going to take some getting used to, isn't it?
For both of us, kiddo. He looked back down at the sheet. No trespassing by order of the Canton County Sheriff's Department. Organic Industries. Ethanol Plant Number 4. Freeman, Iowa. Closed until further notice. You got this by, what, watching it over and over? Rerunning it like a movie?
The no trespassing sign was easy, but the stuff about organic industries and the ethanol plant, yeah. Can't you do that?
I never tried. Maybe once, but probably not anymore.
I found Freeman, Iowa on the computer, she said, and when I ran Google Earth, I could see the factory. Those places are really there.
Dan's thoughts returned to John Dalton. Others in the program had talked about Dan's peculiar ability to find things. John never had. Not surprising, really. Doctors took a vow of confidentiality similar to the one in AA, didn't they? Which in John's case made it a kind of double coverage.
Abra was saying, you could call Bradley Trevor's parents, couldn't you? Or the sheriff's office in Canton County? They wouldn't believe me, but they'd believe a grown-up.
I suppose I could. But of course a man who knew where the body was buried would automatically go to the head of the suspect list, so if he did it, he would have to be very, very careful about the way he did it. Abra, the trouble you're getting me into.
Sorry,
she whispered. He put his hand over hers and gave it a gentle squeeze. Don't be. That's one you weren't supposed to hear.
She straightened. Oh, God, here comes Yvonne Stroud. She's in my class.
Dan pulled his hand back in a hurry. He saw a plump brown-haired girl about Abra's age coming up the sidewalk. She was wearing a backpack and carrying a loose-leaf notebook curled against her chest. Her eyes were bright and inquisitive.
She'll want to know everything about you, Abra said. I mean everything. And she talks.
Uh-oh. Dan looked at the oncoming girl. We're not interesting. Help me, Abra, he said, and felt her join in. Once they were together, the thought instantly gained depth and strength. We're not a bit interesting.
That's good, Abra said. A little more. Do it with me. Like singing. You hardly see us. We're not interesting. And besides, you have better things to do.
Yvonne Stroud hurried along the walk, flipping one hand to Abra in a vague hello gesture but not slowing down. She ran up the library steps and disappeared inside.
I'll be your monkey's uncle, Dan said.
She looked at him seriously.
According to Abra's theory of relativity, you really could be. Very similar.
She sent a picture of pants flapping on a clothesline.
Jeans.
Then they were both laughing.
9. Dan made her go over the turntable thing 3 times, wanting to make sure he was getting it right.
You never did that either? Abra asked. The far-seeing thing?
Astral projection? No.
Does it happen to you a lot? Only once or twice, she considered. Maybe 3 times? Once I went into a girl who was swimming in the river. I was looking at her from the bottom of our backyard. I was 9 or 10. I don't know why it happened. She wasn't in trouble or anything, just swimming with her friends. That one lasted the longest. It went on for at least 3 minutes. Is astral projection what you call it? Like outer space?
It's an old term from seances back 100 years ago and probably not a very good one. All it means is an out-of-body experience, if you could label anything like that at all. But I want to make sure I've got this straight. The swimming girl didn't go into you?
Abra shook her head emphatically, making her ponytail fly. She didn't even know I was there.
The only time it worked both ways was with that woman, the one who wears the hat. Only I didn't see the hat then, because I was inside her.
Dan used one finger to describe a circle.
You went into her, she went into you.
Yes, Abra shivered. She was the one who cut Bradley Trevor until he was dead. When she smiles, she has one big, long tooth on top.
Something about the hat struck a chord, something that made him think of Deanie from Wilmington. Because Deanie had worn a hat? Nope. At least not that he remembered. He'd been pretty blitzed. It probably meant nothing. Sometimes the brain made phantom associations, that was all, especially when it was under stress, and the truth, little as he liked to admit it, was that Deanie was never far from his thoughts. Something as random as a display of cork-soled sandals in a store window could bring her to mind.
"Who's Deanie?"
Abra asked. Then she blinked rapidly and drew back a little, as if Dan had suddenly flapped a hand in front of her eyes.
"Oops, not supposed to go there, I guess, sorry."
"It's okay," he said. "Let's go back to your hat woman. When you saw her later, in your window, that wasn't the same?"
"No, I'm not even sure that was a shining. I think it was a remembering from when I saw her hurting the boy."
"So she didn't see you then either. She's never seen you." If the woman was as dangerous as Abra believed, this was important.
"No, I'm sure she hasn't. But she wants to." She looked at him, her eyes wide, her mouth trembling again. "When the turntable thing happened, she was thinking mirror. She wanted me to look at myself. She wanted to use my eyes to see me."
"What did she see through your eyes? Could she find you that way?" Abra thought it over carefully. At last she said,
"I was looking out my window when it happened. All I can see from there is the street and the mountains, of course, but there are lots of mountains in America, right?"
"Right." Could the woman in the hat match the mountains she'd seen through Abra's eyes to a photo if she did an exhaustive computer search? Like so much else in this business, there was just no way to be sure.
"Why did they kill him, Dan? Why did they kill the baseball boy?"
He thought he knew, and he would have hidden it from her if he could. But even this short meeting was enough to tell him he would never have that sort of relationship with Abra Rafaela Stone. Recovering alcoholics strove for complete honesty in all our affairs, but rarely achieved it. He and Abra could not avoid it.
"Food."
She stared at him aghast. "They ate his shining?"
"I think so."
"They're vampires."
Then aloud,
"Like in Twilight?"
"Not like them," Dan said. "And for God's sake, Abra, I'm only guessing." The library door opened. Dan looked around, afraid it might be the overly curious Yvonne Stroud, but it was a boy-girl couple that only had eyes for each other. He turned back to Abra.
"We have to wrap this up." "I know."
She raised a hand, rubbed at her lips, realized what she was doing, and put it back in her lap.
"But I have so many questions. There's so much I want to know. It would take hours."
"Which we don't have. You're sure it was a Sam's?"
"Huh?"
"She was in a Sam's supermarket."
"Oh, yes.
I know the chain. I've even shopped in one or two, but not around here."
She grinned. "Course not, Uncle Dan. There aren't any. They're all out west. I went on Google for that, too."
The grin faded.
"There are hundreds of them, all the way from Nebraska to California."
"I need to think about this some more, and so do you. You can stay in touch with me by email if it's important, but it would be better if we just..." He tapped his forehead. "Zip, zip, you know?"
"Yes," she said, and smiled. "The only good part of this is having a friend who knows how to zip, zip, and what it's like."
"Can you use the blackboard?"
"Sure, it's pretty easy."
"You need to keep one thing in mind, one above all others. The hat woman probably doesn't know how to find you, but she knows you're out there someplace." She had grown very still. He reached for her thoughts, but Abra was guarding them.
Can you set a burglar alarm in your mind, so that if she's someplace near, either mentally or in person, you'll know?
You think she's going to come for me, don't you? She might try. Two reasons. First, just because you know she exists.
And her friends, Abra whispered. She has lots of friends. With flashlights.
What's the other reason?
And before he could reply,
because I'd be good to eat. Like the baseball boy was good to eat.
Right?
There was no point denying it. To Abra, his forehead was a window.
Can you set an alarm? A proximity alarm? That's...
I know what proximity means. I don't know. But I'll try.
He knew what she was going to say next before she said it, and there was no mind reading involved. She was only a child, after all. This time, when she took his hand, he didn't pull away.
Promise. You won't let her get me, Dan.
Promise.
He did, because she was a kid and needed comforting. But of course, there was only one way to keep such a promise, and that was to make the threat go away.
He thought it again. Abra, the trouble you're getting me into.
And she said it again, but this time not out loud.
Sorry. Not your fault, kid. You didn't
ask for this
any more than I did. Go on in with your books. I have to get back to Fraser. I'm on shift tonight.
Okay. But we're friends, right?
Totally friends.
I'm glad.
And I bet you'll like the fixer. I think you'll get it, because you've fixed a few things in your time, haven't you?
Pretty dimples deepened the corners of her mouth. You'd know.
Oh, believe me, Dan said. He watched her start up the steps, then pause and come back.
I don't know who the woman in the hat is, but I know one of her friends. His name is Barry the Chunk, or something like that. I bet wherever she is, Barry the Chunk is someplace close, and I could find him if I had the baseball boy's glove.
She looked at him, a steady, level glance from those beautiful blue eyes.
I'd know, because for a little while, Barry the Chunk was wearing it.
10. Halfway back to Fraser, mulling over Abra's hat woman, Dan remembered something that sent a jolt straight through him. He almost swerved over the double yellow line, and an oncoming truck westbound on Route 16 honked at him irritably. 12 years ago it had been, when Fraser was still new to him and his sobriety had been extremely shaky. He'd been walking back to Mrs. Robertson's, where he had just that day secured a room. A storm was coming, so Billy Freeman had sent him off with a pair of boots.
They don't look like much, but at least they match.
And as he turned the corner from Moorhead onto Elliot, he'd seen... Just ahead was a rest area. Dan pulled in and walked toward the sound of running water. It was the Saco, of course. It ran through 2 dozen little New Hampshire towns between North Conway and Crawford Notch, connecting them like beads on a string. I saw a hat blowing up the gutter. A battered old top hat like a magician might wear, or an actor in an old musical comedy. Only it wasn't really there, because when I closed my eyes and counted to 5, it was gone.
Okay, it was a shining, he told the running water, but that doesn't necessarily make it the hat Abra saw.
Only he couldn't believe that, because later that night he dreamed of Deanie. She had been dead, her face hanging off her skull like dough on a stick, dead and wearing the blanket Dan had stolen from a bum's shopping cart.
Stay away from the woman in the hat, honey bear.
That was what she'd said.
And something else.
What?
She's the queen bitch of Castle Hill.
You don't remember that, he told the running water. Nobody remembers dreams 12 years later. But he did. And now... he remembered the rest of what the dead woman from Wilmington had said.
If you mess with her, she'll eat you alive.
11. He let himself into his turret room shortly after 6, carrying a tray of food from the caff. He looked first at the blackboard and smiled at what was printed there. "Thank you for believing me." "As if I had any choice, hun." He erased Abra's message, then sat down at his desk with his dinner. After leaving the rest area, his thoughts had turned back to Dick Halloran. He supposed it was natural enough when someone finally asked you to teach them. You went to your own teacher to find out how to do it. Dan had fallen out of touch with Dick during the drinking years, mostly out of shame, but he thought it might just be possible to find out what had happened to the old fellow. Possibly even to get in touch if Dick was still alive. And hey, lots of people lived into their 90s if they took care of themselves. Abra's great-grandma, for instance, she had to be really getting up there. "I need some answers, Dick, and you're the only person I know who might have a few. So do me a favor, my friend, and still be alive." He fired up his computer and opened Firefox. He knew that Dick had spent his winters cooking at a series of Florida resort hotels, but he couldn't remember the names or even which coast they had been on. Probably both. Naples one year, Palm Beach the next, Sarasota or Key West the year after that. There was always work for a man who could tickle palates, especially rich palates, and Dick had been able to tickle them like nobody's business. Dan had an idea that his best shot might be the quirky spelling of Dick's last name. Not H-A-L-L-O-R-A-N, but H-A-L-L-O-R-A-N-N. He typed Richard Halloran and Florida into the search box, then punched Enter. He got back thousands of hits, but he was pretty sure the one he wanted was third from the top, and a soft sigh of disappointment escaped him. He clicked the link, and an article from the Miami Herald appeared. No question. When the age as well as the name appeared in the headline, you knew exactly what you were looking at. Noted South Beach chef Richard Dick Halloran, 81. There was a photo. It was small, but Dan would have recognized that cheerful, knowing face anywhere. Had he died alone? Dan doubted it. The man had been too gregarious and too fond of women. His deathbed had probably been well attended, but the two people he'd saved that winter in Colorado hadn't been there. Wendy Torrance had a valid excuse. She'd predeceased him. Her son, however. Had he been in some dive, full of whiskey and playing truck-driving songs on the jukebox when Dick passed on? Maybe in jail for the night on a drunken disorderly? Cause of death had been a heart attack. He scrolled back up and checked the date. January 19th, 1999. The man who had saved Dan's life and the life of his mother had been dead almost 15 years. There would be no help from that quarter. From behind him, he heard the soft squeak of chalk on slate. He sat where he was for a moment, with his cooling food and his laptop before him. Then slowly, he turned around. The chalk was still on the ledge at the bottom of the blackboard, but a picture was appearing anyway. It was crude, but recognizable. It was a baseball glove. When it was done, her chalk, invisible but still making that low squeaking sound, drew a question mark in the glove's pocket. "I need to think about it," he said, but before he could do so, the intercom buzzed, paging Dr. Sleep. Chapter 9. The Voices of Our Dead Friends. 1. At 102, Eleanor Ouellette was the oldest resident of Rivington House in that fall of 2013, old enough so her last name had never been Americanized. She answered not to Ouellette, but to a much more elegant French pronunciation, Ouellet. Dan sometimes called her Miss Ooh-la-la, which always made her smile. Ron Stimpson, one of four docs who made regular day rounds at the hospice, once told Dan that Eleanor was proof that living was sometimes stronger than dying.
"Her liver function is nil, her lungs are shot from 80 years of smoking, she has colorectal cancer, moving at a snail's pace but extremely malignant, and the walls of her heart are as thin as a cat's whisker, yet she continues."
If Azriel was right, and in Dan's experience he was never wrong, Eleanor's long-term lease on life was about to expire. but she certainly didn't look like a woman on the threshold. She was sitting up in bed stroking the cat when Dan walked in. Her hair was beautifully permed. The hairdresser had been in just the day before, and her pink nightie was as immaculate as always, the top half giving a bit of color to her bloodless cheeks, the bottom half spread away from the sticks of her legs like a ball gown. Dan raised his hands to the sides of his face, the fingers spread and wiggling.
Ooh la la, une belle femme, je suis amoureux.
She rolled her eyes and cocked her head and smiled at him.
Maurice Chevalier, you ain't, but I like your chair. You're cheery, which is important. You're cheeky, which is more important. And you've got a lovely bottom, which is all important. The ass of a man is the piston that drives the world, and you have a good one. In my prime, I would have corked it with my thumb and eaten you alive. Preferably by the pool of Le Meridian, in Monte Carlo, with an admiring audience to applaud my front side and backside efforts.
Her voice, hoarse but cadenced, managed to render this image charming rather than vulgar. To Dan, Eleanor's cigarette rasp was the voice of a cabaret singer who had seen and done it all, even before the German army goose-stepped down the Champs-Élysées in the spring of 1940. Washed up, maybe, but far from washed out. And while it was true she looked like the death of God in spite of the faint color reflected onto her face by her craftily chosen nightgown, she had looked like the death of God since 2009, the year she had moved into room 15 of Rivington 1. Only Azzy's attendant said that tonight was different. "I'm sure you would have been marvelous," he said.
"Are you seeing any ladies, Shell?"
"Not currently, no. With one exception, she was years too young for amour."
"A shame, because in later years, this,"
she raised a bony forefinger, then let it dip,
"becomes this. You'll see."
He smiled and sat on her bed, as he had sat on so many. "How are you feeling, Eleanor?"
"Not bad."
She watched as he jumped down and oil out the door, his work for the evening done.
"I've had many visitors. They made your cat nervous, but he stuck it out until you came."
"He's not my cat, Eleanor. He belongs to the house."
"No,"
she said, as if the subject no longer interested her much.
"He's yours."
Dan doubted if Eleanor had had even one visitor, other than Azriel it was. Not tonight, not in the last week or month, not in the last year. She was alone in the world. Even the dinosaur of an accountant who had overseen her money matters for so many years, lumbering in to visit her once every quarter and toting a briefcase the size of a sob's trunk, had now gone to his reward. Miss Ooh-la-la claimed to have relatives in Montreal.
"But I have not quite enough money left to make visiting me worthwhile, cher."
"Who's been in, then?" Thinking she might mean Gina Weems or Andrea Botstein, the two nurses working the 3-2-11 in Riv 1 tonight, or possibly Pole Larson, a slow-moving but decent orderly, whom Dan thought of as the anti-Fred Carling, had stopped by for a natter.
"As I said, many. They are passing even now. An endless parade of them. They smile. They bow. A child wags his tongue like a dog's tail. Some of them speak. Do you know the poet George Sepharis?"
"No, ma'am, I don't." Were there others here? He had reason to believe it was possible, but he had no sense of them. Not that he always did.
"Mr. Sepharis asks, are these the voices of our dead friends, or just the gramophone? The children are the saddest. There was a boy here who fell down a well."
"Is that so?"
"Yes, and a woman who committed suicide with a bedspring."
He felt not even the slightest hint of a presence. Could his encounter with Aberstone have sapped him? It was possible. And in any case, the shining came and went in tides he had never been able to chart. He didn't think that was it, however. He thought Eleanor had probably lapsed into dementia, or she might be having him on. It wasn't impossible. Quite the wag was Eleanor Ooh-la-la. Someone, was it Oscar Wilde, was reputed to have made a joke on his deathbed. Either that wallpaper goes or I do.
You ought to wait, Eleanor said.
There was no humor in her voice now.
The lights will announce an arrival. There may be other disturbances. The door will open. Then your visitor will come.
Dan looked doubtfully at the door to the hall, which was open already. He always left it open so as he could leave if he wanted to. He usually did once Dan showed up to take over.
Eleanor, would you like some cold juice?
I would, if there were time,
she began, and then the life ran out of her face like water from a basin with a hole in it. Her eyes fixed at a point over his head and her mouth fell open. Her cheeks sagged and her chin dropped almost to her scrawny chest. The top plate of her dentures also dropped, slid over her lower lip and hung in an unsettling open-air grin. Fuck, that was quick. Carefully, he hooked a finger beneath the denture plate and removed it. Her lip pulled out, then snapped back with a tiny plip sound. Dan put the plate on her night table, started to get up, then settled back. He waited for the red mist the old Tampa nurse had called the gasp, as though it were a pulling in instead of a letting out. It didn't come.
You are to wait.
All right, he could do that, at least for a while. He reached for Abra's mind and found nothing. Maybe that was good. She might already be taking pains to guard her thoughts. Or maybe his own ability, his sensitivity, had departed. If so, it didn't matter. It would be back. It always had been, at any rate. He wondered, as he had before, why he had never seen flies on the face of any Rivington House guest. Maybe because he didn't need to. He had Azzy, after all. Did Azzy see something with those wise green eyes of his? Maybe not flies, but something? He must.
Are these the voices of our dead friends, or just the gramophone?
It was so quiet on this floor tonight, and still so early. There was no sound of conversation from the common room at the end of the hall. No TV or radio played. He couldn't hear the squeak of Poole's sneakers or the low voices of Gina or Andrea down at the nurse's station. No phone rang. As for his watch, Dan raised it. No wonder he couldn't hear its faint ticking. It had stopped. The overhead fluorescent bar went off, leaving only Eleanor's table lamp. The fluorescent came back on, and the lamp flickered out. It came on again, and then it and the overhead went off together. On. Off. On. Is someone here? The picture on the night table rattled, then stilled. The dentures he had removed gave a single, unsettling clack. A queer ripple ran along the sheet of Eleanor's bed as if something beneath it had been startled into sudden motion. A puff of warm air pressed a quick kiss against Dan's cheek, then was gone. Who is it? His heartbeat remained regular, but he could feel it in his neck and wrists. The hair on the back of his neck felt thick and stiff. He suddenly knew what Eleanor had been seeing in her last moments. A parade of ghosty people. The dead passing into her room from one wall and passing out through the other. Passing out? No, passing on. He didn't know Seferis, but he knew Auden. Death takes the rolling in money, the screamingly funny, and those who are very well hung. She had seen them all, and they were here But they weren't. He knew they weren't. The ghosts Eleanor had seen were gone, and she had joined their parade. He had been told to wait. He was waiting. The door to the hall swung slowly shut. Then the bathroom door opened. From Eleanor Ule's dead mouth came a single word. Danny.
2. When you enter the town of Sidewinder, you pass a sign reading, Welcome to the Top of America.
It isn't, but it's close. 20 miles from the place where the eastern slope becomes the western, a dirt road splits off from the main highway, winding north. The burned-in wood sign arched over this byway reads, "Welcome to the Bluebell Campground. Stay a while, partner." That sounds like good old western hospitality, but locals know that more often than not the road is gated shut, and when it is, a less friendly sign hangs from it. Closed until further notice. How they do business is a mystery to the folks in Sidewinder who'd like to see the Bluebell open every day the upcountry roads aren't snowed in. They miss the commerce the Overlook used to bring in and hope the campground would at least partially make up for it, although they know that camper people don't have the kind of money the hotel people used to pump into the local economy. That hasn't been the case. The general consensus is that the campground is some rich corporation's tax haven, a designated money loser. It's a haven, all right, but the corporation it shelters is the True Knot, and when they are in residence, the only RVs in the big parking lot are their RVs, with Rose the Hat's Earth Cruiser standing tallest among them. On that September evening, 9 members of the True were gathered in the high-ceilinged, pleasantly rustic building known as Overlook Lodge. When the campground was open to the public, the lodge served as a restaurant that put on 2 meals a day, breakfast and dinner. The food was prepared by Short Eddie and Big Mo, Rube names Ed and Maureen Higgins. Neither was up to Dick Halloran's culinary standards. Few were, but it's hard to screw up too badly on the things camper people like to eat. Meatloaf, macaroni and cheese, meatloaf, pancakes drenched in log cabin syrup, meatloaf, chicken stew, meatloaf, tuna surprise, and meatloaf with mushroom gravy. After dinner, the tables were cleared for bingo or card parties. On weekends, there were dances. These festivities took place only when the campground was open. This evening, as 3 time zones east, Dan Torrance sat beside a dead woman and waited for his visitor, there was business of a different sort to transact in Overlook Lodge. Jimmy Numbers was at the head of a single table that had been set up in the middle of the polished bird's-eye maple floor. His power book was open, the desktop displaying a photograph of his hometown, which happened to be deep in the Carpathian Mountains. Jimmy liked to joke that his grandfather had once entertained a young London solicitor named Jonathan Harker. Clustered around him, looking down at the screen, were Rose, Crow Daddy, Barry the Chink, Snakebite Andy, Token Charlie, Apron Annie, Diesel Doug, and Grandpa Flick. None of them wanted to stand next to Grandpa, who smelled as if he might have had a minor disaster in his pants and then forgotten to shower it off, a thing that happened more and more frequently these days, but this was important, and they put up with him. Jimmy Numbers was an unassuming guy with a receding hairline and a pleasant, if vaguely simian face. He looked about 50, which was 1/3 of his actual age. "I googled lickety-spliff and got nothing useful, which is what I expected. In case you care, lickety-spliff is teenage slang that means to do something really slow instead of really fast."
"We don't," Diesel Doug said. "And by the way, you smell a trifle rank, Gramps. No offense, but when was the last time you wiped your ass?"
Grandpa Flick bared his teeth, eroded and yellow, but all his own at Doug. "Your wife wiped it for me just this morning, Deez. With her face, as it happens. Kinda nasty, but she seems to like that kind of thing."
"Shut your heads, both of you," Rose said. Her voice was toneless and unthreatening, but Doug and Grandpa both shrank away from her, their faces those of chastened schoolboys. "Go on, Jimmy, but stay on point. I want to have a concrete plan, and soon."
"The rest of them are going to be reluctant, no matter how concrete the plan is," Crow said. "They're going to say it's been a good year for steam. That movie theater thing, the church fire in Little Rock, and the terrorist thing in Austin. Not to mention Juarez. I was dubious about going south of the border, but it was good."
"Better than good, actually,"
Juarez had become known as the murder capital of the world, earning its sobriquet with over 2,500 homicides a year. Many were torture killings. The pervading atmosphere had been exceedingly rich. It wasn't pure steam, and it made you feel a little whoopsie in the stomach, but it did the job.
"All those fucking beans gave me the runs," Token Charlie said. "But I have to admit, the pickings were excellent."
"It was a good year," Rose agreed. "But we can't make a business of Mexico. We're too conspicuous. Down there, we're rich Americanos. Up here, we fade into the woodwork. And aren't you tired of living from year to year? Always on the move and always counting canisters? This is different. This is the motherload." None of them replied. She was their leader, and in the end, they would do what she said. But they didn't understand about the girl. That was all right. When they encountered her for themselves, they would. And when they had her locked up and producing steam pretty much to order, they'd offer to get down on their knees and kiss Rose's feet. She might even take them up on it. "Go on, Jimmy, but get to the point."
"I'm pretty sure what you picked up was a teen slang version of lickety-split. It's a chain of New England convenience stores. There are 73 in all, from Providence to Presque Isle. A grammar school kid with an iPad could have nailed that in about 2 minutes. I printed out the locations and used World 360 to get pics. I found 6 that have mountain views. 2 in Vermont, 2 in New Hampshire, and 2 in Maine."
His laptop case was under his chair. He grabbed it, fumbled in the flap pocket, brought out a folder, and handed it to Rose.
"These aren't pictures of the stores. They're pictures of various mountain views that can be seen from the neighborhoods the stores are in. Once more, courtesy of World 360, which is far better than Google Earth, and God bless its nosy little heart. Take a look and see if any ring a bell. If not, see if there are any you can definitely eliminate."
Rose opened the folder and slowly went through the photographs. The 2 showing Vermont's Green Mountains she put aside at once. One of the main locations was also wrong. It showed only 1 mountain, and she had seen a whole range of them. The other 3, she looked at longer. Finally, she handed them back to Jimmy Numbers. "One of these." He turned the pictures over.
"Fryeburg, Maine. Madison, New Hampshire. Anniston, New Hampshire. Got a feel for which one of the 3?
Rose took them again, then held up the photos of the White Mountains as seen from Fryeburg and Anniston. "I think it's one of these, but I'm going to make sure."
"How are you going to do that?" Crow asked.
"I'm going to visit her."
"If everything you say is true, that could be dangerous."
"I'll do it when she's asleep. Young girls sleep deeply. She'll never know I was there."
"Are you sure you need to do that? These 3 places are pretty close together. We could check them all."
"Yes," Rose cried. "We'll just cruise around and say we're looking for a local girl, but we can't seem to read her location the way we normally can, so give us a little help. Have you noticed any junior high girls around here with precognition or mind-reading talents?"
Crow Daddy gave a sigh, stuck his big hands deep in his pockets, and looked at her.
"I'm sorry," Rose said. "I'm a little on edge, all right? I want to do this and get it done, and you don't have to worry about me. I can take care of myself."
3.
Dan sat looking at the late Eleanor Ulle, the open eyes now beginning to glaze, the tiny hands with their palms upturned, most of all at the open mouth. Inside was all the clockless silence of death. "Who are you?" thinking, "as if I didn't know." Hadn't he wished for answers?
You grew up fine. The lips didn't move, and there seemed to be no emotion in the words. Perhaps death had robbed his old friend of his human feelings, and what a bitter shame that would be. Or perhaps it was someone else masquerading as Dick. Something else.